Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Jesse Bell, filling in for Dinah Jansen this week. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, and it covers the potential of labor action at Queen's University in 2025.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Recent strike votes from Queen's University workers signal possible labor disruptions in the new year. A release from QP earlier this week confirmed that across three Kingston groups, 96% of members voted in favor of strike action. This includes trades, custodial and food service workers, educational and laboratory technical staff, and library technicians. According to the release, most of these Queen's workers have seen their wages fall below inflation by 11 to 14% in recent years, and many have had to take on second or third jobs to make ends meet. For those in trades, hourly wages are $10 to $15 lower than at other Kingston employers. QP254 President Marie Edwards, representing technicians, spoke to the current state of negotiations in an interview with CFRC.
What have you been experiencing so far, and what are you hearing from your fellow Queen's workers? Where is the university falling short here?
The biggest problem among our members right now is wages. The constraint of 1% wage increase over the last 3 years has impacted the members greatly, especially considering how inflation has driven the prices of everything up. So if you look at our buying power, we've gone down in the last number of years by roughly 10% of buying power. So members are having, they're having a hard time putting money away to save. Some are having difficulty making ends meet with rent. And some of it, we have a fairly broad range of salary. Some of them are having difficulty with food. They're experiencing food insecurity.
And I was wondering if you could speak to the circumstances and the state of negotiations that's brought us here where Queen's workers are ready to strike in the new year.
They're feeling that the university is not listening when it comes to compensation. There was a request to have a wage opener clause in the last collective agreement because, we knew that the wage constraint did come down from government. The university denied our request for this. And we're concerned that they're going to come into it looking for a similar increase that they've given us in the last number of years. So in the last 10 years, our wage increases have been an average of 1.25.
While it is anticipated that wage negotiations will be difficult, Edwards did report progress in non-wage related bargaining, which took place just prior to the interview. You did mention that you just came back from bargaining with non-wage related issues. How did that go?
That went very well. There's been good discussion on the language and the changes. Some of the changes were to align the collective agreement with language from labor laws, that kind of thing. Some of them were also to recognize, for instance, the recognition of a family member may mean different things to different groups.
When asked for comment by CFRC, the university simply responded stating they are engaged in separate talks with several unions, and they remain committed to reaching negotiated agreements that are capable of being ratified by the parties involved. While workers are ready to strike, Edwards has hope an agreement will be reached before it comes to that.
The latest update from Queen's, since it was released that QP workers are ready to strike, was simply that you're still in negotiations. Do you foresee any change in circumstances before the new year that would prevent a strike?
We're all working towards reaching an agreement to avoid a strike. But the workers want to be in a position where they can, if they're going to strike, we want to strike in a manner where it will have the most impact so that we can get it dealt with and finished as quickly as possible, because really everyone wants to be back at work.
And do we have any ideas on timeline?
We have not been offered any monetary proposals at this time. The university has not given us any idea when we might be expecting those. We do have a number of bargaining dates scheduled for January, towards the end of January, the 24th, 28th, and 31st. So I'm hoping that there will be some monetary proposals on the table at that time.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next, I'll be reading a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Town Council's decision to allocate leftover funds from 2024 to 2025 and 2026. In a decision aimed at balancing financial relief with future needs, the Council of the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands has opted to allocate leftover financial relief funds over the 2025 and 2026 budget years. Council made the decision during a budget meeting on December 12th at Lansdowne's Council Chambers. In total, $77 million in relief to OPP police municipalities is being provided. Council was presented with three scenarios on how to allocate these relief funds. One suggested allocating leftover funds to 2025, one suggested allocating leftover funds to 2026, and another approach was a hybrid between the two, wherein the remaining financial relief funds would be split over 2025 and 2026 pending billing adjustments. Council opted for the hybrid approach. In this scenario, the remaining $182,100 in financial relief left over would be split between 2025 and 2026, with the majority backloaded for 2026. The benefit of this scenario is that it includes a transfer of $122,000 to the Tax Rate Stabilization Reserve Fund to be used in 2026 to help mitigate the increase in the expected 2026 OPP billing statement, particularly the adjustment for 2024. Councillors Jeff Lackey, Brock Gorrell, Brian Mabey, Terry Fody, and Smith Gatke voted in favor of the hybrid approach, where Councillors Angela Kelman and Mark Jamieson favored carrying the entire relief amount into 2026. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Over now to Ted Evans, the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island, with a story about the creation of a potential hydrogen peaking plant in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Public Energy Incorporated is looking at converting the old Kingston Generation Plant in Loyalist Township into North America's first hydrogen peaking plant. This type of plant produces hydrogen at night when energy costs are cheaper and stores it to be sold when it's needed. The company presented council with plans at their year-end meeting and spoke about the benefits of hydrogen. The retired plant is located on Taylor Kidd Boulevard and has access to Lake Ontario. The plan would include an investment of $400 million into Loyalist Township and nearly 130 new jobs brought to the area. Chairman of Public Energy Inc., John Douglas, explains the conversion process and their willingness to rename the facility.
We started looking for a retired gas project that had an interconnection that we could use and basically replace those gas turbines with new 100% hydrogen turbines, which is what we're proposing to do for the Kingston power plant. And we're quite happy to let whoever rename that facility, whether it's Loyalist Generating Station or Loyalist Hydrogen Station.
Douglas spoke about the jobs it could create in the area and noted the interest they've had from large companies.
The thing to keep in mind is we're talking about a $400 million project that will generate 100 construction jobs, probably 15 to 20 great operational jobs for the 30-year life. And this will be the first such hydrogen peaker plant in North America. So we have both GE and Siemens that are pretty keen to be the first.
Douglas notes the unique opportunity Ontario provides.
A common way to make hydrogen is through a chemical process using an electrolyzer. So electrolyzers have been around for a long time. There's nothing new there. But Ontario offers a unique opportunity for this because, of course, at night, our energy, our electricity is pretty cheap. So we're proposing to make hydrogen at night with cheap electricity, like for a penny a kilowatt, and storing that hydrogen on site to burn in a turbine to make electricity when it's required.
Douglas spoke about the support they've received and the steps they'll need to take going forward.
We've spent the past year talking to the Ministry of Energy. We first started with Minister Smith, but now, of course, we have Minister Lecce and his assistant deputy, Minister Oosterhoff. So they're very familiar with this project. They really like it. So does the Premier. So we have lots of political support. But I think as we've learned from the LT1 exercise, municipal support is critical now. There's all kinds of new regulations from an agricultural perspective on renewable energy brought in by not just the provincial government, but by the federal government. So there's lots of check marks that need to be acquired for a project like this.
Douglas details the history of how he and co-founder Dr. Dennis Stein came up with the plan.
Dennis and I go back a fair ways. So when he came to Canada, we started working together on sort of what's going to be the next big thing. And so we decided that distributed generation will be part of the future. Dennis advised the German government on their energy transition, and people were just starting to talk about that back then. And so we started Public Energy. It's based in Toronto. We're an independent power producer. We own and operate power plants in Ontario, and currently we operate 7 power plants for industrial customers.
Stein talks about the benefits of hydrogen.
It's probably the first molecule that was created in the universe because it's the simplest molecule and it has the highest energy density of everything that we know in our nature. So it's a great energy storage device. And using electricity as an energy form that can be transferred from, as we said, from the grid at night into the hydrogen and back into the electricity, is actually, from the physical perspective, excellent way to advance the power systems in this province. It's really about providing a service that's carbon free, that's sustainable, and that's superior to a battery service, I would say, in that case.
Stein explains the value of the service they propose to offer.
This is not about electricity and energy. This is about the service that this hydrogen can provide to the grid. So the value, we are not buying one set kilowatt hour and then selling it for 10 cents. This is not the case. So we are selling them a service that they can call whenever they want. And that service has a value that goes way beyond kilowatt hour pricing. So it's not really about kind of gaming the 1 cent against 10 cents. It's really about having an equipment that produces that service, and that's the electricity in any given time when they need it, and the rotating mass and inertia and all of that that's coming out of this turbine that has much, much higher value at that given moment in time than ISO requires than a kilowatt hour they can buy on the market. So they have energy markets and then a capacity market. So we are turning energy into the capacity basically and selling this as a capacity service.
Douglas explains why a unique situation with power creation in Ontario makes this a good time to consider switching to hydrogen.
People in Canada were talking about, hey, let's make hydrogen to export to Germany, or let's make hydrogen to use for the transportation business. And we came up with a different concept, mostly from Dennis's sort of experience and expertise of, hey, let's make hydrogen with this super cheap energy at night. And sometimes in Ontario, with our nuclear power, we can't turn off our nukes. So we actually pay Americans to take our power. It's bid negative at night, like we'll pay them a penny or sometimes 2 cents to take the energy because we can't afford to turn off a nuke. If you turn off a nuclear reactor, it might take 6 months to turn it back on because you have to go through all this protocol. So that's the unique situation of Ontario and why we think it makes this an incredible opportunity for growth and for investment.
Douglas notes the environmental impact the plant could have.
Companies like Volkswagen and these large global manufacturers, they care about carbon now because their boards are saying they want suppliers that have a low carbon footprint. So by setting up shop in Ontario, they're basically ahead of the game. So we have a green grid. We're going to help green the grid here by a hydrogen peaker plant.
Douglas speaks about the future of the project and its benefits.
We will be looking for municipal resolution of support at some point. What we're talking about is 100% emission-free, a $400 million project that will be one of the first, and a unique opportunity to make it almost like a hydrogen sort of energy center that will attract more interest and could be used as a kind of a center of excellence. We're talking about basically off-the-shelf components used in a new way. That's the innovation that we're proposing.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn noted his interest.
Producing power from hydrogen is kind of intriguing to me, so I've been quite interested in this.
Councillor Paul Proderick noted a potential hang-up in the process.
The emission thing, I think that's unique. The one thing that obviously in the starting stages is some kind of safety plan that's communicated to the community, because I think in past experiences that has been a major roadblock.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Next is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about an outstanding achievement of a young entrepreneur in Prince Edward County.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
Emily Cole is a young woman with two small children who moved to the county a few years ago and immediately saw a void and a need in the community for a children's secondhand clothing and equipment store. Realizing the gaps in her retail experience, she discovered and qualified to take the RISE programs while working full-time and caring for her family. When she was ready to get started, she encountered a great deal of resistance from landlords when trying to secure a location for Meadows Baby and Kids. Her ambitious nature and perseverance paid off when she finally secured a space in Picton. She was recently recognized for her resilience when she was awarded the Dr. Paul Garfinkel Resilience Award, that is one of four awards given annually in conjunction with the RISE program. The national organization is geared to people who have experienced profound personal challenges, and RISE provides free training, mentorship, and low-interest business loans. Despite the furnace blowing in the background, Emily tells us more about her journey, the RISE program, and her award.
You saw that there was a need.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, having two small kids myself, it's there's only so many places for families and other people to go that have kids' things, whether that's recreational things in the county or purchasing clothing, toys, that sort of stuff. There's not a lot of selection, which would lead us to have to drive to Belleville or Trenton to go and get things for them.
And you noticed that there were families around here that don't have the means to get to Belleville on a regular basis.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of a retirement community here, but the other side of it with younger families is that there's a lot of low-income people here. And unfortunately, that catchment of people doesn't have the means to drive. They don't have a license, or they don't have money to purchase a car or pay insurance and all the other costs that come along with it, to be able to do those 35, 45 minute drives out to Belleville or Trenton. So it's just not an option, or they can save and get a family member or a taxi to take them out there maybe once a month to get what they need, but that's it. So there's really not a lot of option within the county specifically for people.
How did you get hooked up with RISE?
Yeah, so I thought about going on this journey and opening this store, I guess probably three years ago now. But at the time I was working at the physiotherapy clinic and trying to figure out, I knew I was ambitious enough. I had come from a retail background before when I was younger in merchandising, cashier, managing, all that sort of stuff. But when it came to business with cash flow predictions and payroll and all that sort of stuff was a gap that I needed to learn. So I did a Google search one day of business classes online, and I came across the RISE program, which offered at the time an 8 or 12 week course of once a week virtually, and it was free, which was a great opportunity for me to be able to, aside from my day job, do this extra training, kind of do this background planning, but also it gave me the tools of all of those gaps that I didn't have at the time. It partnered me up with a mentor who was invaluable in other business day-to-day information. Yeah.
The Paul Garfinkel Resilience Award, how did that come about?
Yeah, so RISE every year has a selection process where you can apply to these grants. It's quite a lengthy application process to go through. You have to have done one of their courses in order to be able to apply as well. Because RISE is a national program. No one ever thinks out of thousands of candidates that it might actually come down to you. It's quite an honor to be listed through them. They're an amazing program. They really are there for the individual person rather than big businesses.
And you talked about how difficult it was to find a space.
We're not related to anyone here, so we don't have those deep-rooted county connections that a lot of families have. But I think, unfortunately, a large part of it was that I was female and I'm young, and I wanted to build a business around children and family. And to the general public of male business owners, landlords, building owners, that just didn't suit what they thought would be successful. They didn't really think that it was something that was needed in the area, although none of them had grandkids or kids that were in this catchment either. So they really, I don't think, quite understood the need for a business like this. Thankfully, perseverance really got me where I am.
What do you attribute your resilience to?
Unfortunately, I attribute it to struggle. Unfortunately, I've had a very good life, but I've also had a hard life for different reasons, where I've always been an ambitious person, but in order to reach the goals that I've wanted to reach, I've had to sacrifice, or I've had to persevere to get through those situations. When I was younger, I had dreams of being a veterinarian or a teacher or jobs like that that eventually weren't attainable because I wasn't able to get financing to go away from school or go away to school. So I ended up working a full-time and a part-time job to help pay bills at home and save a bunch of money. And I ended up doing that for 2 years, which allowed me to fully pay for my college for the two-year program that I did. So I was thankful to come out of school with no debt. But while I was in school, it was still a struggle. I was working a full-time job, a part-time job, and going to school full-time. After I was done school, I was able to purchase a new-to-me car. I ended up buying my first home when I was 23. But to do it alone without any help or support or anything like that from family or my now husband, I was with him at the time, but I ended up purchasing the home myself. I've learned that if you want something, there's nothing that can stop you. There's always something that'll stand in your way, or an obstacle, financial, emotional, situational, that'll come up. But if you want something bad enough, there's always a way to make it happen. So with a little bit of perseverance or resilience, it doesn't matter what the situation is, that you'll be able to figure it out. A lot of people have a hard time sacrificing nowadays. We're so used to the extras we have, like brand new phones that come out, or big 60-inch TVs, brand new cars, all that sort of stuff. But when you really sit back at the end of the day and you have a big goal, especially a big financial goal that you want to reach, it's okay to live like you don't have money, even if you do have money. But it doesn't come without sacrifice.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about a Coburg police investigation into workplace harassment allegations.
Coburg Police Chief Paul Vandegraaff says he will consult an outside police agency to investigate an anonymous letter alleging illegal activities, racism, sexism, and cronyism within Coburg Police. In November, Today's Northumberland published unverified accusations of a letter from a person claiming to be a member of the police service. The publication of the letter outraged Coburg Police, the Police Services Board, and the Police Officers Association, all condemning Today's Northumberland for publishing an unverified report without seeking comment. The anonymous letter was then forwarded to the Inspectorate of Policing by the Police Board earlier this month. A response from the Inspectorate of Policing to the Police Board indicated the Inspector General declined to investigate the complaint as it was anonymous. Vandegraaff did not specify at Tuesday's Police Board meeting what third-party agency would be used to conduct the investigation.
Now that we have board's directions, staff will start to dissect the letter, but we'll be going to a third police agency for assistance.
Legal counsel provided direction to the board on how to proceed with the allegations. In a December 12th letter from attorney Glenn Christie of Hicks Morley, he recommended that the police board examine its current policy structure for misconduct allegations and reprisals due to reporting of misconduct. Christie also suggested Vandegraaff and the board need to probe whether the complaint rises to workplace misconduct, which may warrant further investigation. Christie stated police leadership should not concern itself with the author of the complaint, but rather if there are workplace allegations. Police Board Chair Ron Kerr agrees with Vandegraaff that the accusations need further review.
Unfortunately, there can be considerable expense at this, which is really unfortunate, but this is the path we have to follow. So we'll do so.
A timeline on when the investigation would start was not stated. For CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Up next is CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 2nd, daytime high of 0 degrees with a 40% chance of flurries. Friday, January 3rd, we are going to see a daytime high of minus 4 dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Saturday, January 4th is going to be the coldest day of 2025 thus far, with a daytime high of minus 7 dropping to minus 11 overnight. Sunday, January 5th, we're going to see a daytime high of minus 5 with an overnight low of minus 7. And then Monday, January 6th, 2025, daytime high of minus 3, overnight low of minus 9. And that concludes your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.